I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live.
Good morning. I'm Alexandra Cox, and I'm a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. Just last week, San Francisco supervisors rejected a plan to build a new jail in the city. You were just listening to the No New SF Jail Coalition at a meeting convened in March 2015 by the Sheriff of San Francisco on the environmental impact of a proposed new jail. This week's show is devoted to campaigns against jail building across the United States. These campaigns have had some success in some places like San Francisco, where, as a result of the work of the No New SF Jail Coalition, this month, the San Francisco supervisors listened to the coalition and rejected the plan to rebuild the old jail and replace it with a new, smaller jail. Instead, the Board of Supervisors formed a task force to investigate alternatives to incarceration, including expanded pretrial diversion, mental health services, drug treatment, and other programming. Community members, nonprofit organizations, and formerly incarcerated people will be included on the new task force. The city had actually applied for and received $80 million in state funds towards the project to build a new jail, and they're now going to have to give that money back. The topic of jails is an increasingly important one in our discussion about mass incarceration. According to the Vera Institute of Justice, since 1970, there's been a more than four-fold increase in the average daily number of people held in the nearly 3,000 jails in the United States, from 157,000 people in 1970 to 690,000 people in 2014. Incarceration has grown the most outside of the largest counties in the United States. Mid-sized and small counties, which account for the vast majority of jails, have largely driven that growth, with local jail populations increasing since 1970 by 4.1 times in mid-sized counties and 6.9 times in small counties. In contrast, jail populations in large counties grew by only 2.8 times. Locally, this has a lot of significance. In Greene County, the jail and prison incarceration rates are 560 per 100,000 people, and in Columbia County, they're 609 per 100,000 people. These are extremely high rates of incarceration for such small areas. Today's show is going to be devoted to the topic of jails, and I'll be interviewing someone who's involved in a local effort to protest jail building in Dutchess County, as well as individuals who are thinking about this issue at the local and national level. I begin today's show with an interview with Jerry Wilmot, who's part of the End the New Jim Crow Coalition in Poughkeepsie and part of a project to oppose the building of a new jail there.
I work with NJAN, End the New Jim Crow Action Network, in Poughkeepsie, and I've also been working with the Kingston chapter.
Could you start by telling us a little bit more about what is going on in Poughkeepsie with the jail? What is the jail fight about?
Okay. They have been told by the Corrections Board of New York State that they need to make changes and bring their prison, well, their jail, up to better standards and to accommodate more inmates because they have been housing out their many people all over upstate New York. So this is giving them an impetus to say that they need an expanded jail. They've been doing studies, and their most recent study actually shows that they don't need as many beds as that were in the original study by their Criminal Justice Council. So it's showing that, but they're saying there was a question posed to them on their external, in front of their external advisory committee, and the question was, what model are you using to determine the number of beds you need in your new jail? And they said, we're not using any model.
And how did the opposition to the jail building movement begin? What was the genesis of it?
The Engine Group had read the book, The New Jim Crow, by Michelle Alexander, and they formed a community group. And those people decided that we were against any expansion of the jail when there started to be talk of building a new jail. And actually, the talk about building a new jail has been a topic for a long time, even through the previous administration. And the previous administration actually refused or told the state, we're not building a new jail. Now they're calling it the Justice Transition Center. And I believe one of the reasons is because they're saying that they want to build a jail where they can decommission parts of it if they need to and put it to other uses. I know one of the parts of the proposal that is very interesting is that they've acquired a Taylor manufacturing plant there, former Taylor manufacturing plant, and that's going to be the new headquarters for the sheriff. Apparently now they want to level the place and, you know, start from scratch.
And basically build this new justice structure in the existing location
right.
that the jail is.
Right.
And what else would be a part of this proposed campus?
I'm not sure. They haven't really been explicit about that. They did one of the reforms, so-called reforms, that they have instituted is they have a crisis center now. And they have trained their some members of the police force in crisis intervention so that those people who may have mental health problems can go to this 23-hour center and possibly have medications adjusted and not become part of the jail population.
And what can you tell us about who is in the Poughkeepsie jail?
Many of the people are there because they have... drug charges, drug-related charges, or they have acted out in a way that, you know, indicates mental illness and they need a place to put them because they're a danger to themselves or others, I guess. So I think something like 87% of the people there have some kind of addiction history. According to the public defender, his office, he said that only about 30%, maybe 10 to 30%, it varies, have any kind of violent history.
What are some of the arguments that you've made? You members of your group go to the Criminal Justice Council meetings. You've been kind of engaging in protests and other actions. What are some of the core arguments that you've made to people in the county about why this new jail should not be built?
Okay, some of the core arguments are, first of all, many people are returned to jail because of violations of parole or probation. And those are not violations of the law itself, as it's written. There are things like violating curfew or leaving the county, and I've heard of people leaving the county for funerals, etc., and, you know, being back in the system because of that, not paying fines, you know, all sorts of you know, things that aren't violent in any way, shape, or form. So that's one of the things they could do. Another thing that they could do is reinstitute the drug court. There is a small one, but we need more drug courts. Another thing they can invest in is rehabilitation, especially long-term rehabilitation for people who are addicts, because often people are turned away if they don't think that they're an immediate threat and they're going to kill themselves today on an OD today, then they won't necessarily treat them. Won't even take them into the crisis center sometimes. It has to be a real emergency because they don't have the facilities. Another reform we've asked for is setting up some kind of bail fund so that people who don't have money for bail. I know a woman with 3 children, was her first offense, a felony offense. They said that they were charging her with that, and she ended up having to give up her apartment. They wouldn't allow her to return to her public housing. She lost that. She lost custody of her children. And in the meantime, she also ends up at the end, no trial, just plea bargaining. At the end, she admitted to a felony that she said she never committed, just so she could get home to her children. And this woman, now her life is totally upside down. And the judge said to her when he was releasing her, she said, "Why was I transported to court 2 and 3 times, and the prosecution never showed up?" And he said, "Oh, that's because they probably didn't have a strong enough case against you. The system can't help a woman like that." So another thing we've proposed is the Drew House model, which is used in Brooklyn, and it's very successful, and it's subsidized housing. It's housing that's HUD housing. The women that go there, they go with their children if they're first-time felony charged, and they can stay there. I believe it's usually 18 months to 2 years. They're given family counseling. They have rehabilitation. They have to attend certain meetings, perhaps. They get mental health care, and they get a chance to get on their feet. Many of them get their GED and possibly start some community college. And they're on their feet when they leave there, and no one has recidivated in that group. That's a real diversionary program. I don't know of anything like that in the county. And the housing would be paid for by HUD. And in Brooklyn, the services are provided by private funding.
Could you talk a little bit more about the availability and access to housing and other social services in Poughkeepsie for people who are, you know, dealing with some real challenges around poverty and criminalization?
Well, there are some really good housing programs through Hudson River Housing, but there's an extremely long waiting list. In fact, I had a woman living in my home who's been on the waiting list for months, and they keep telling her it's imminent, you know. And she's a well-educated woman who's been through a domestic violence situation and some continuing harassment by her former mate. And so, you know, someone who can probably function on her own if she could get housing. But, you know, it's pretty hard to get a job when you don't have a permanent address where people can reach you. And, you know, you probably, if you're using the shelters, it's not all that easy to, they won't allow you to bring any of your clothing to the shelters. So how do you get dressed and look presentable and face the world to get employment when you're in a situation like that?
And what about alternatives to incarceration programs in Poughkeepsie?
Well, I don't know if there are real alternatives. I mean, there is a program of electronic monitoring. There is something called transitional housing. But many of those women, I see them every week because of some volunteer work I do. Many of those women have been to jail anyway. And the problem is that once you've spent more than 24 to 48 hours in jail, you already have a higher recidivism rate. Another argument, again, for more real alternatives, is that it costs so much less to give someone the counseling or mental health services they need outside of jail than it does to put them in jail and try to present some kind of program in there when they're in there such a short time. And then you have to make all kinds of connections to the mental health community or the rehabilitation community. And many times things don't work out. That's one of the things that the people on the criminal justice council are stressing, that there'll be a continuum of care. But why put someone in jail in the first place if their problem is addiction or their problem is a mental health problem?
And so what is the argument that you hear from people on the council who are in support of building a new jail?
The main argument that I've heard from the county executive is that all these people are housed out all over the place. Well, don't arrest them in the first place. You know, hello? And then if they do have a problem that needs to be addressed, don't put them in jail to address it. It costs us as taxpayers and our community. Not only does it cost the hurt that it does to the family, and especially when there's children, it's amazing, you know, that you would want to give yourself a multitude of problems that you're going to have to deal with later, when it's $12,000 a year to provide mental health care in the community, and it's something like $60,000 a year to provide just the bed in the jail. And then, you know, if there are children involved and they have to go into foster care, that's a family of two, that's another probably $100,000.
If you could envision a world in which we don't have to rely upon jails to solve our problems, what would you build?
Okay, so I wouldn't have to build anything right now in Dutchess County, because the Wasaic Center, which was a center for people with disabilities, is empty. State could turn it over to us for a dollar. Something recently happened in Massachusetts just like this. And I have a plan. It will be a job training and rehabilitation center. There are so many buildings there, and you could house people there if need be for a time to get training that they need. But I'm looking at that training in terms of what kinds of jobs are there in Dutchess County, and what kinds of educational resources do we have that might be shared or might be even people may volunteer to help. So I'm thinking that place had a huge farm. It was self-sustaining. They could farm there. People could be trained to farm in the latest techniques. People could become managers. They could have Poughkeepsie is a food desert, the city of Poughkeepsie. They could grow crops that are then in turn brought to the city, or even brought to the jail in the city for the people who, those few people who do need to be watched 24 hours a day, okay? There may be some people like that. As I said, maybe 10 to 30%. I don't know, but I doubt if it's even 30%. And people from the CIA may be willing to come and train some of the men and women there in various aspects of managing a restaurant, serving food, presenting food, and cooking. And then I thought, you know, okay, what about these men and women who are working as corrections officers? Well, I thought perhaps the Teamsters Union, which is the corrections officers union, could become involved with apprenticeship programs there. They could gradually grow this center by remodeling these buildings one by one and turning them over to certain purposes, you know, aquaponics here, or you know, management training here, and a sort of skill school, whatever. And the union might apprentice a certain number of people to learn construction, to rehab these buildings gradually. And the corrections officers could be retrained to, first of all, you might need security there, of course, but they could be retrained as job trainers also, and they'll have a future, because, and, you know, hopefully some other people out there will have a vision to change it from a criminal punishment system, which is what it really is, not justice.
Right. And it's so consistent with I think the name of your campaign is Jobs, Not Jails.
Right. Absolutely. That is the name of our campaign. And that's the very simple message we gave when the county executive was giving his state of the county address. We just stood with this banner that said, Jobs, Not Jails. And we mean it. And actually, Poughkeepsie's unemployment rate and their graduation rate and their poverty rate is so low that if you compare it to Baltimore, which everybody said, oh, look how horrible, that's why riots happened in Baltimore, or it was really a rebellion, but why Baltimore erupted. These websites where they tell you where's the best place to live, they said, don't live in Poughkeepsie, live in Baltimore.
Visiting with and participating in prisoner-facilitated discussion groups at Greenhaven Prison, that is sort of the foundational point for a lot of the work I do now. In sort of recent recent history, I co-founded and was intimately involved with a group called Decarcerate Monroe County. This is while I was in graduate school in Bloomington, Indiana, where Indiana University is. And Decarcerate Monroe County coalesced around a proposal to build sort of a massive carceral expansion project that the community called a Justice Campus. The Justice Campus was this proposal for an 85-acre kind of massive complex of three facilities, a new jail, a new juvenile detention facility, and a work release center, each of which on their own would have dramatically expanded the capacities of the community to incarcerate, detain, surveil its residents. And taken together, it was the most, by far, the largest proposal for carceral expansion in the county's history. So 85 acres, I think each of the constitutive institutions would have more than doubled, or I mean all the way up to sort of quadrupled the size of the existing facilities at the time. And what, so very troubling for those of us who are really opposed on principle to any new construction of carceral facilities. But what was curious at the time was that the Justice Campus, the kind of discourse and logic surrounding and advocating for the Justice Campus, were pretty much devoid of any reference to punishment, to law and order, to getting tough, any of those ideas that kind of grew the system and that got many of us involved in fighting it. The Justice Campus instead was really premised on ideas about therapeutic justice and education and rehabilitation, and was imagined as this kind of bucolic, beautiful campus that looked and felt more like a college campus than a jail. And that was difficult for us, for a lot of us, to both to accept, but also to think about trying to disrupt, because here were a lot of well-intentioned people who, and I'm talking about the people who were advocating for the Justice Campus, well-intentioned people who actually could talk about mass incarceration and yet who believed that in Bloomington they could do it differently. And it was challenging to those of us. We had to sort of come up with or think through kind of distinct arguments and distinct logics to try and intervene in the proposal.
When you talk about carceral expansion, could you kind of explain to our listeners what you mean by that?
For us, it meant to be blunt, it meant new cages. It meant new institutional capacities. So the jail, the impetus for the Justice Campus was that the jail was dramatically overcrowded. So to alleviate jail overcrowding, and I'm talking about dramatic jail overcrowding, I mean upwards of, I think the population was close to twice the size of what the jail at the time of the Justice Campus proposal was designed to accommodate. So it was overcrowded by 100% or something like that. And there was no juvenile detention facility for judges to send youth, quote-unquote, in need of detention to in the county, so they had to send them out of the county upwards of an hour away. So legitimate problems related to our over-reliance on incarceration. But for me and for others in the community, the problems of incarceration and our over-reliance on incarceration were then met with a solution, quote-unquote, a solution premised on more incarceration. So the solution to problems of incarceration was more incarceration. And that, for us, that kind of foundational principle of carceral expansion or more incarceration had to be rejected. The idea that regardless of the intentions behind the proposal for the Justice Campus, our read of history, our read of politics meant that we had to, on principle, say that this was a bad idea. And of course, I think most people would say that organizing, to the extent that we have to have in this moment in time, to the extent that we have jails and prisons, they should be organized around the very things that the Justice Campus was being discussed as housing. around therapeutic justice, around treatment, around education. Sure. So our opposition was not at all around opposing those ideas. Our opposition was around increasing carceral capacity, increasing the size of jails and prisons and work release centers. I mean, even building entirely new facilities that didn't exist already in the community, increasing or building those things anew in order to then maybe make them about therapeutic justice, rehabilitation, and education. And so we said, these ideas are well-intentioned and they are, you know, we appreciate them, but let's sever, you know, sever the ways in which they are sutured to this idea of carceral expansion and instead think about getting people out. Let's look at who's in jail. Let's get people out first. Let's cease our over-reliance on that. Let's cease our over-reliance on putting youth in detention. And then begin to think about what things aren't available in the community and look to sort of put our time and resources and imaginations there.
Right. And so, of course, you're talking about your new book, Progressive Punishment, Job Loss, Jail Growth, and the Neoliberal Logic of Carceral Expansion, which is out this fall with NYU Press.
So Progressive Punishment examines the kind of liberal complicity of expanding the carceral state. And it examines it in an extended case study. And it looks at the political economy and history and geography of one particular community and the ways in which that history and the forces of what we call neoliberalism, those forces structured that community's inability to think outside a very kind of confined vocabulary and confined vision of how we can address the problems of jail overcrowding and over-reliance on incarceration. The Justice Campus actually wasn't built. We take some credit for that. I think the bottoming out of the economy in a way helped as well in that all of a sudden a $75 million massive project became fairly untenable. But I also had a lot of politicians who had previously supported the campus tell me and tell the carceral Monroe County that we sort of disrupted the logic that had for them led to support for the Justice Campus. We gave them sort of an alternative vocabulary with which to think about things like safety and services and things like that. Now, the reason I bring that up is because just because the Justice Campus proposal went off the table doesn't mean that our work ceased or that carceral expansion projects died. And in fact, it was talking with folks who were part of communities most affected by this stuff that helped direct us to sort of new problems that emerged around policing, around other so-called alternatives like drug court, mental health court, and truancy court, and things like that.
Criminal justice reform is part of daily conversations in politics and policy and on the front page of every newspaper. And you know, we have this sort of historic, what some people call moment. But, you know, what's interesting is that there could be a turn, which I think you're cautioning against in your book a little bit, that that I think we definitely see signs of happening. So as states increasingly reduce their prison populations and shift towards forms of control that are seen to be softer and nicer and kinder, I think what you're asking, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, is whether in fact that that kind of shift is really just a way of somehow prettifying what we've previously been doing.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. And I think what's amazing to me is, I'll just be very honest with you and your listeners, when I was writing the book and, you know, even in the years in which it was sort of in various stages of production, I was somewhat worried about the ways in which it might come across as fairly provincial or almost anecdotal, that it really just told one community story and wasn't especially relevant. And for all I know, it may still be that. But I have to say that looking to sort of the larger national landscape of mass incarceration, we see these shifts, like the one that you're talking about in Poughkeepsie and in New York State more broadly, but certainly also in places like California, where there is this growing bipartisan consensus around mass incarceration that seems to be leading towards certain kinds of reforms that may lead to some states closing prisons, as is happening in New York, or to states letting some people out, letting a lot of people out of prison, like in California. But I think you're right. I think the book cautions wholly embracing that without looking to the ways in which either or both counties are sort of picking up the slack. And so the state is sort of devolving criminal justice and punishment to the county level. So in California, for example, something like 36 of the 50 counties, something along those lines, have signified that they will be either expanding their jail capacity or building entirely new jails. So that on the one hand, just new carceral infrastructure at the municipal level. But also, I think the logics themselves, while they may be, or while the discourses might be changing, and so you have people even on the right talking about reform and rehabilitation, I would strongly hesitate to say that those logics or those discourses are operating outside of the broader logics that comprise the carceral state, right? So even as we might have these baseline agreements with folks about the need to get people out of prison, I think the book cautions wholly embracing the current moment as some kind of paradigmatic shift.
Right, because what hasn't shifted is who has the power to punish and who is punished.
The blues come falling, they fall like drops of rain. The blues come falling, they fall like drops of rain. I got to spend my Christmas locked up in jail again. In jail on Christmas Day again. Ain't that a pain? Oh, baby, baby, baby. Ain't that a pain? Oh, Santa, Santa, Santa. Come here to me in jail. Oh, Santa, 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 come here to me in jail. Bring me a Christmas present, someone to go my bed. In jail on Christmas Day. Again, ain't that a pain? Oh, baby, baby, baby. Ain't that a pain? This food here, Santa, it ain't fit to eat. This food here, Santa, it ain't. Won't you come and bring me a plate of turkey meat? In jail on Christmas Day again, ain't that a pain? Oh, baby, 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 ain't that a pain? The jailhouse blues have got me. They've got the best of me. The jailhouse blues have got me. They've got the best of me. My baby doesn't love me. I've got no Christmas tree. In jail on Christmas Day. Again, ain't that a pain? Oh, baby, baby, baby. Ain't that a pain?
You're
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. I'm Alexandra Cox, and I'm one of the members of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. Today's show is devoted to the topic of jails. You just heard the song Christmas in Jail by Leroy Carr.
I'm James Kilgore. I'm a writer and an activist. I'm based in Urbana, Illinois, and I've been active in a campaign against building a jail in my community for the past 3.5 years. In 2012, the local law enforcement authorities came forward with a proposal to spend about $30 million on a new jail. And some of us in the community had actually been involved in a study group of the new Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. And when we saw this jail project coming forward, we saw this as an example of the new Jim Crow at a local level, particularly since we've did some study and found that more than 50% of the people in the jail were black. In a county that's only 13% black. So we decided that we were going to oppose this jail and try to begin to mobilize people in the community against it. And as we proceeded in the campaign, we realized that we had to develop some kind of an understanding of alternatives to incarceration and how the county might spend money on more productive uses than jail building.
And why was the county proposing to build a new jail?
Well, the excuse they used was that the county had two jails, and one jail was in very bad condition. And they proposed to close that one down and build some other cells at the site of the second jail in order to fill in the gap. But in actual fact, the jail that they wanted to close was typically about a third full. So it wasn't a case of overcrowding.
And could you talk a little bit about the process of mobilizing the local community and sort of the folks that you work with against this project? What kinds of work have you done to kind of educate people about, you know, why this project might be bad? Because I think that's a struggle in Poughkeepsie. I mean, everyone sort of thinks, well, a new jail could be better in terms of creating better conditions of confinement for people.
Exactly. That's the precise starting point that we had, because a lot of the people who are generally sympathetic to the problems of poor people, who are sympathetic to race and gender issues, were making the case that, well, we really need better facilities for the people that are in the jail, so we can't let people stay in the kind of situation that they're in. And our argument from the beginning was, we agree with that, but what we say is we should close that downtown jail and find ways to not incarcerate so many people so we don't need to build more jail cells, and then let's think about how we might spend that money better. Mm. So, for example, we did a survey where we went door to door in two neighborhoods in our county and asked people if they had 30 million, well, actually it was 20 million at the time, if they had $20 million to spend in the county, what would they spend the money on? And we also asked them if they thought spending $20 million on the jail was a good thing. Well, only 7% of the people said they thought spending that money on the jail was a good thing, and no one said what they wanted to do with that $20 million was build a new jail. Almost everyone said they wanted something like better schools or more jobs or anything that would help address some of the poverty and inequality in the county, except for building a new jail. But we also did all kinds of other things. We had public forums. We brought people from other counties that had successfully fought against the jail, people in Monroe County, Indiana, which is not far from us. We held public forums on alternatives to incarceration. We did all kinds of things. We reached out to a lot of organizations. We visited churches. We visited, you know, communities and talked about the idea of alternatives to incarceration, and that's what we began to push. And we also eventually changed our name from No More Jails to Build Programs, Not Jails.
And what's the current status of the campaign?
while we're still fighting, one of the points that we've emphasized is that you need to be have a sort of inside and outside strategy. That is, that you have to mobilize people in the community to oppose a jail, but you also have to build relationships with the people who are the ultimate decision makers. And this is all often, for many activists, this is not a real comfort zone, hanging out with county board members or city council members, trying to figure out ways to get to put your message that they will understand and will relate to their needs. So we drew quite a bit on the experience of people in other parts of the country, mostly from, you know, from reading and communicating with people by email, getting some ideas of where we might go next. And I think now, even compared to 3 years ago, there's a lot more experience of people fighting these things as the movement against mass incarceration has gained more momentum.
One of the things that you've written about is sort of is actually about the momentum of mass incarceration, of the a kind of resistance to mass incarceration, and the emergence of right-wing and conservative critiques of mass incarceration. And I really would love for you to sort of spell out how you understand what you've called carceral humanism. What's emerged in the context of this critique of mass incarceration?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek term, the idea of carceral humanism, meaning that you're going to be sensitive and supportive of other human beings by locking them up in jail cells. But this is what law enforcement in many communities has come up with as a solution to the growing opposition to jail building and prison building. So what they've said is that they're really not pursuing a tough-on-crime or a law-and-order regime. They're not trying to punish people, but they actually are trying to provide services for people. So one of the big things in our campaign locally has been that there's a number of people in our county jail who have mental health issues, and we have no community-based mental health services for people who don't have insurance. And so the sheriff has been campaigning for building a new jail by saying, well, what we need is a much better mental health facility inside the jail. And all of a sudden, after years of this tough on crime mantra, he starts talking about, well, we really have to treat these people properly. We need to give them better services. We need to have psychiatric services. We need to have, you know, better living facilities so they're not being kept in isolation and so forth. And all of this is appealing to people who believe that people who are incarcerated should be treated as human beings. But the main point really here is that mental health has been shifted into jails because mental health facilities and communities have been shut down. So our position is to say we need that money that's going to go into that jail mental health facility to be reallocated into the community to build alternatives to incarceration. Because in so many communities, if someone is having a mental health crisis in a public space, the only place for the police to take them is to the jail. But we're arguing that the county can do better than that, that they can build a facility and they can deal with people through a health system perspective, not a prison system perspective. And this has taken other forms as well. We've heard terms like gender responsive jail, saying that, oh, well, we need a better facility for women because the facility that we have doesn't meet the specific needs of women. It might not have a good visiting facility so they can visit with their children. Well, we think the best place for them to be visiting with their children is in the community, and most of the people that are in these local jails really shouldn't be there in the first place. About 70% are pre-trial, waiting a court adjudication, and they're being kept there because they can't make the bails that are being set for them.
One of the kind of stories for me that I think about a lot is that told by Stanley Cohen, who wrote about, you know, the kind of decarceration movement in the 70s and warned about what he called net widening and mesh thinning, and this idea that if we close prison and jails, what we have to be concerned about and attuned to are the kind of broader concerns about social control that emerge in the community, about the emergence of electronic surveillance and electronic monitoring and other kinds of forms of community-based control that effectively continue to kind of punish people in their communities. And I wondered sort of your thoughts about this emergence of these new technologies and also what's different now than the conversation in the 1970s when there was another era of decarceration?
I spent a year on an electronic monitor as a condition of my parole, and I've done quite a bit of research on it. I've interviewed a lot of people that have been on electronic monitoring, and it seems as if it's a genuine, you know, alternative to incarceration because you're not locked up. But in fact, the conditions that most people on, particularly on parole, face with electronic monitor is that they're under house arrest and there are no clear guidelines for when they can leave the house or not, and they have to get permission from a parole agent to go out of the house for anything. And so the parole agents are steeped in the idea that these people should be punished and they should be controlled, so they become in many cases very dominant and draconian in terms of the rules they make for people. And a lot of people just find that it's incredibly stressful to have this constant fear that if you, for example, you are given permission to go out to work, that if you're taking a bus home and the bus is 5 minutes late and you get home 5 minutes late, you can end up being sent back to prison. Or in many cases, the technology fails and people might be reported as missing from their home when they're sitting in their house and so forth. There's a whole lot of risks, and it also places an incredible burden on families who have to basically be, my wife said that at times she felt like she was my prison guard, that she had to make sure that I was in the right place at the right time and constantly be monitoring and controlling my activities the way in which an institution would. And then I think the other part of the net widening is that these electronic monitoring technologies are generally run and controlled by private companies. And in fact, the GEO Group, the second biggest private prison corporation, is also the owner of what most people think is the biggest electronic monitoring provider in the country, BI Incorporated. So they're constantly looking for ways to apply this to new, you know, customers, so to speak, looking for other kinds of people who might be targets for being monitored. So I'm concerned in the future that they're going to look for ways to monitor people who have mental health histories, who might have histories of even being on state benefits, and try to rationalize this as a way of keeping an eye on them and making sure that tax dollars are being spent properly. We've already seen the extension of this to a lot of people in juvenile justice who aren't really guilty of anything, who are being put on electronic monitor because they've missed too many days of school. Or we've seen the same thing with people with immigration cases who are waiting to have a case heard about deportation or asylum. So I think these new technologies are a completely different framing than what we had in the 1970s. And I think we've also seen since then, we've seen the rise of an ultra conservative, fiscal discipline oriented forces in the Republican Party that really see cutting back on mass incarceration as simply an exercise in saving money, and they're happy to dump people into communities and not spend another cent on them and let them survive in skid rows and slums and living in cardboard boxes or whatever they must do as long as they're out of sight. I've lived in South Africa, for example, and the urban model there, which is a holdover from the previous system of racial segregation of apartheid, is that you have a core city, which is kind of like a middle class suburb, and then around the cities you have these informal settlements, which are basically unregulated places with no services, no electricity, no water. People are making houses out of all kinds of scrap material, and they get no, there's no tax dollars going into these places, but they're kind of left alone so they're not a drain on the resources of the inner city. And these areas are actually bigger than the, you know, than the core city. They have more people in the living in these informal settlements than in the core settlements. So when I see that and I look at slums in places like India, or I look at Skid Row in Los Angeles, for example, where you have thousands of people, mostly black, a lot of people with mental health issues, just living on the sidewalk with all their possessions out there, you know, and they're, as long as they stay within the area where they're supposed to be, they don't get bothered too much by, you know, by police and law enforcement, but they don't cost taxpayers money. You know, mass incarceration really has been an exercise in criminalizing the poor and in developing a kind of mass hatred of people who are poor and all the public manifestations of poverty. Mm-hmm. So that's resulted in all these ordinances in so many cities where they ban people from sleeping in public, or they ban people from laying down on a park bench, or they ban people from, you know, from aggressive panhandling, living in their car, all kinds of things that people do when they don't have the money for other kinds of all other kinds of alternatives. And the conservative view on mass incarceration is we can reduce the prison numbers and that will save us money. And mm-hmm. and I would consistently argue that ending mass incarceration is not going to save any money at all if we're really going to end it. It has the money that's gone into corrections needs to be going into rebuilding the communities where people who have been incarcerated primarily come from. And that's overwhelmingly poor inner city communities, but we're seeing also now more and more that poor rural communities have been incarcerated, and in poor rural communities, jail building has become you know, a big economic and political statement over the course of the last 30 years. And in these rural areas, I mean, a lot of the discourse and discussions around, you know, mass incarceration haven't really taken place. In a lot of these places, there's not a significant kind of, even if you like, liberal establishment that might be a source of support for that, that kind of critical thinking. So the kind of law and order forces have managed to really dominate both the discourse and the and the and the budgets of these areas. So I think there's a lot of work to be done.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be free.